Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later in the program, poet James McGrath will be with us. And also, we are going to be hearing about Memory Lines, which is a contemporary opera that's at the Lenzic this weekend. Right now, yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's Wednesday and it's Animal Day. Darren Llewellyn joins us. He's a veterinarian at Smith Veterinary Hospital. And Bill Hutchison, who is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome.
Good morning, Santa Fe.
Mary Charlotte.
And Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
And Santa Fe.
Everybody, good morning, doggies, kitties, lizards, and birds who also listen to this program, although they're not counted. So we were going to talk today a little bit about dog behavior.
Yep.
And I was reading the Dog Whisperer's book over the last couple of weeks.
And boy, did that get my hackles up!
I know it got the fur running off across the back of your
absolutely
of your head. But I found it quite compelling, especially the philosophy of dog training, which is that you have to be basically the leader of the pack.
Absolutely.
What do you think about that?
You know, Cesar Millan's not far off the mark when it comes to behavior issues with dogs. I think the 4 points that he really stresses is that dogs require exercise, affection, discipline.
In the order, exercise, discipline, and affection.
Yeah.
Affection being third.
And in most of the behavioral issues that we see in our canine companions relate to us actually kind of flopping or reversing some of these things that Cesar Millan has recommended. Oftentimes, we are not giving our dogs exercise and giving too much affection, i.e. food. And so we have not only behavior issues, but it also leads to unhealthy pets. You know, we're just like in America with human beings, the majority of pets in America are overweight, and it's because they are not getting, you know, the required amount of exercise that they need, and we are overfeeding them. And my, you know, when I talk to owners and saying, well, my pet's too fat, and you know, a lot of times we will look for medical reasons first as far as why they're overweight. And then when that comes back that everything is normal as far as their metabolism goes, then it's a matter of changing what's going on at home, changing the lifestyle of the pet so that they become a healthier pet. Many, many folks have pets that just don't get exercise. And I can tell you, just putting your dog in the backyard to let him run around is not exercise for your pet. You need to go and interact with your pet. You need to get your pet out, get him walking, playing, doing vigorous activities to burn calories, because the,
including your own calories.
including your own calories, exactly. And and oftentimes I will tell owners of overweight pets that I know you love your pet, but food does not equal love.
It sounds an awful lot like you could apply some of this stuff to child rearing, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so oftentimes people say, well, you know, he just whines for food all the time, and I just feel sorry for him, so I give him a little extra. I give him a biscuit here and there, a couple
of
table scraps.
If I hold out and whine for another 30 seconds, she'll break and I'll get the biscuit.
Exactly. And it's really kind of a reverse situation where the dogs are actually training the owners to overfeed them. Dogs really don't have an innate ability to know when they are full.
My terrier, huh?
Yeah, they will eat until they balloon. And so it is of the utmost importance that we monitor how much they're eating and keep track of that and don't overfeed our pets. And then with the discipline side of what Mr. Millan has written in his book, oftentimes we are substituting affection for discipline. And the dog really needs to be in a structured environment. If you think of dogs in the wild, and this is really where Cesar Millan derives most of his training methods, is what would a wild dog do? What would a wild dog in a pack do. In a pack, there's always an alpha dog, the pack leader, the one that keeps everyone in check, the one that makes sure that everyone knows that they're the alpha dog and what they say goes. It's no different in a home environment. And basically what we have to do is substitute ourselves as that alpha dog in the pack. And when, just like what Bill was saying, you know, the dogs start training you to do what they want, they're the alpha dog and you're the submissive dog, and they're getting away with murder and
not
you're
only
letting
that,
them.
But it's stressful for them because they actually do not know how to run a household.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so a lot of times, a lot of these behavior issues we see, especially separation anxiety, it's when these dogs are getting too much affection and not enough discipline, and so they come to need this affection. And so when you leave the home and that source of positive reinforcement and affection leaves, it drives them bonkers. And they can literally go crazy. They'll destroy things. They will bark incessantly and make your neighbors extremely angry with you. And it can lead to a lot of problems. And Bill can attest to this. The number one reason for a abandoned dog, somebody that brings a dog to the shelter, is for a behavioral issue.
Absolutely.
And if we can start to change those things, I think that our humane societies and shelters will start seeing less and less abandoned dogs and be less crowded. And so it's just going to work out best for everybody.
Another point that he made in the book that I thought was excellent is that you can't love a behavior problem out of a dog.
Absolutely.
If a dog is doing a bad behavior problem and you say, "Oh, Fluffy, don't do that. I love you so much." The dog isn't going to understand. It's going to feel that it's rewarded
right.
for whatever that behavior problem
exactly.
was. You actually have to tell them that that's not the right thing to do. And he said you can't train them by scaring them, because that doesn't work either. You just have to train them by establishing the proper limits and the boundaries of who's in charge.
Exactly. And this goes a lot with aggression problems, too. Food aggression, territorial aggression, play aggression. These dogs are not being kept in check. Basically, you have to step up and be the authoritarian figure in the household and let these dogs know that these behaviors are not acceptable, and you know, reward the good behaviors, whereas a lot of times if you start to ignore the bad behaviors and let them know that that is not acceptable, they will want to do those behaviors that where they get rewarded and they get the affection from the owners, because that's going to make them feel good. And so those behavior problems can start to turn and get rid of those bad behavior problems.
I think another issue about all of this that comes up is that while you might want to do nothing but have a love fest at home, you actually have to have a certain amount of emotional distance from them and establish authority in a calm way and not get too excited with them all the time, because that makes them respect you less. One of the things that actually has helped, I've been doing it lately, is there's a song I sing before we go for the walk, and the dogs know that song in my household. But instead of getting them all excited and jumping up and down, what I've been doing lately is getting them to be very calm and sit, and I won't put the leash on them until they sit. And that makes the going out of the house process a lot smoother.
Right.
And involves a lot less leash pulling.
And what you're doing basically is telling them that you know, the bad behavior of getting excited and jumping and pulling on the leash and things like that are not going to be accepted, and you basically want them to do a good behavior, like sitting and waiting for the leash to be put on before they get to go out on something enjoyable like a walk, so that basically they're being rewarded for their good behavior by getting to go on that walk, instead of saying, okay, you're acting like a holy terror and being very rambunctious, so I'll just take you out on the walk anyway.
I'll reward you by taking you on the walk.
Exactly. So you're actually reinforcing those bad behaviors when you're doing those things.
Now, Bill, when we were talking the other day about César Milan.
Mm-hmm.
You said that he's not so respected inside the veterinary community.
Inside the behavior
the behavior in part of the veterinary community, you know, I would hesitate to speak for all veterinarians, but I think all the things we're talking about are spot on. I mean, with the exception of the emotional distance, I think part of having a really strong emotional relationship with your animal is having a really strong emotional relationship with your animal. But as with kids, and let me disclaim here that I'm not saying dogs are like kids, but as with kids, having structure and discipline and consequences for behaviors are really, really important. Milan, however, I think, you know, this is a fairly unpopular thing to say, but I think his methods are terrible, and there are a lot of people who spend a lot of time in the behavior community. You know, animal behavior, which really is animal psychology, has changed a lot over the last decade and a lot over the last several decades. And a lot of what we used to know about animal behavior came from some studies in the 1940s done on wolves, which are the wild dogs that, versions of the wild dogs that Darren was talking about. Now, this is research that was done with wolves. So we get to learn a lot about basic dog behavior from that. But what we don't learn is about what dogs who have been domesticated for 15,000 years are like with people, with human beings. Now, are some of the basic ideas similar? Absolutely. But are the relationships exactly the same? Absolutely not. There are some methods he uses, for example, well, let me back up a little bit. About 3 or 4 weeks ago in the New York Times Magazine, there was a really excellent article on a shelter in Texas that was using some really exciting new behavior techniques and temperament testing in their adoptions. That's spreading through shelters throughout the country. The Santa Fe Animal Shelter has a pretty spectacular behavior department, and not only do we temperament test all of our dogs before we move them to adoption, but we spend a lot of time with dogs who are not in the best shape for adoption and help them modify their behaviors. And we use the same ideas, which are discipline, exercise, and affection, and a lot of positive reinforcement. One of the things that, and I have to confess that I haven't read Milan's book, but I've seen his TV show a lot, and I usually have to turn it off about two-thirds of the way through because I'm just fit to jump out of my bed and tear the cable box out of the wall and throw it outside.
You're fit to just break your leash right off of the chain.
Absolutely, absolutely. I definitely need some positive reinforcement at that point. But the alpha role, for example. This is something that he does with dogs, and he puts them on their back. Now, most dog trainers who are worth their salt will tell you that if you want to get bitten in the face, the alpha roll is a great technique to use.
Absolutely.
If you want to demonstrate your dominance with a dog, the alpha roll may not be the best thing to do.
Hang on a second. Yeah. I had a behavior problem with my little dog, Milk, who would attack the older dog, Honey, and it was a real problem. And so I finally put him on his back. I gave him a good talking to, did it 3 times, it never happened again.
I think I'm sure it was very effective. I'll also say that the only dogs I've ever been bitten by at the shelter were terriers. 100% of the dogs that I've been bitten by are terriers. And this may have been because of the relationship you had with your dog, but this is a man going into strangers' homes with dogs that he's unfamiliar with and who are very unfamiliar with him. And all of a sudden, there's this little short guy who's coming at you and doing all this stuff, and it can be very overwhelming and very, very dangerous.
Absolutely.
I've also seen him use the restraint and choke collars in such a way that the dog acquiesces more because its brain is starved of oxygen. Than because it's actually behaving.
That's not good. Mm-hmm.
And Mary Charlotte and I were talking a little bit about one of his worst techniques, which is called flooding, where the dog is so psychologically overwhelmed by the thing that it's scared of or the thing that it does wrong that it shuts down psychologically. What you see on TV is this really well-behaved dog, but what you really have is basically the same thing as a kid who's been yelled at so many times and doesn't understand what he's doing wrong, so he just doesn't really do anything.
It just shuts off.
Yeah.
And I completely agree with Bill. In most behaviorists, you know, there are several board-certified behaviorists that are veterinarians, will agree with this. Cesar Millan's techniques are not to be desired for, but what he is basing his techniques on, the general concepts, are basically the foundation of behavior medicine. And really, the problem between Mr. Milan and the veterinary community is that you know, his techniques are very, for lack of a better word, archaic. They're very overbearing and Bill is right. It's a surefire way of either shutting your dog down completely, emotionally, or ending up getting yourself injured.
Well, some of them. Some of the techniques seem to be fine. I mean, the basic idea of keeping this authority, it's quite funny. He actually says, your role is the calm, authoritative role, and their role, your dog's, is the calm, submissive role. And he had a woman who was very scared of her dog because it always pulled on the leash and she was afraid of it. And it turned out she was an actress. And he said, well, why don't you play Cleopatra while you're on your walk? And she stood with a high regal bearing, and the dog behaved better because she took on that Cleopatra regal role. And, I mean, that's a technique, but that it does seem to work.
I'll say that, you know, I really want to echo Darren on this, because I want to make it very clear that I think his principles are sound. I think his techniques are... Well, let me give you two quotes. Gene Donaldson, director of the San Francisco SPCA Academy for Dog Trainers, called him arcane, violent, and technically unsound. And the Animal Humane Association, in a letter to National Geographic to get them to take his show off television, called him inhumane, outdated, and improper.
Good heavens.
And, of course, he doesn't have any credentials. Now, these techniques that he... let's just go back to the principles. The principles are excellent. The techniques, and I think the problem with his techniques is it doesn't take into account the individual nature and individual personality of every dog that you deal with. The principles allow you to take into account the fact that my big dog is different than my little dog, and that they both need discipline, exercise, and affection, but they may need that customized to fit them and to fit their personalities in a way that it's very much like teaching. You cannot teach the same lesson to 30 kids in a classroom and expect them all to understand it in the same way. Every dog has its own personality, and dogs learn differently. Now, they are a little more basic than human beings, but they still are individual personalities. And to take his techniques and apply them whole cloth to dogs as a species will definitely get you into trouble. To take the principles, his principles, which are not really his principles. I mean, they're basic principles of dog behavior. That will get you somewhere, and that will help you have a relationship with your dog that I think is more rewarding, is more emotionally intimate, and is better for healthier psychologically and biologically for both you and your animal.
One of the points that he makes, which I found very surprising, is that dogs are not actually people with four legs.
No, nor are they
separate species.
Nor are they wolves with wolf behaviors. And
right.
I think, I mean, we have had a symbiotic relationship with these animals for a long, 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 long time.
15,000 years plus.
Yeah, and we need to treat them like dogs that have a symbiotic relationship with humans. Not like wolves, not like little kids, but like the creatures that they really are.
It's
like trying to you wouldn't train a cat with the same techniques you'd use to train a dog.
Well, you wouldn't train a cat at all.
Yeah, God save you if you tried.
What's happening down at the animal shelter?
I want to keep talking about Cesar Millan. Now I've got my dander up.
He's rare.
The first time I ever heard of Cesar Millan was on an episode of South Park where Mrs. Cartman hired him to train Eric.
Yes, I remember this one. And I think that may, you know, not to keep bashing the poor guy, but that may be one of the most accurate portrayals of Cesar Millan that I've seen.
I think probably, I mean... I'm a sucker for people's life stories. So the first half of the book, or the first few chapters of the book, he actually tells about how he learned what he learned. And he grew up on a farm in Mexico and watched dogs very carefully his whole entire childhood. And eventually had his own dog when they moved to the city. And then crossed the border and worked in a dog grooming parlor. It was his first job. And he was the only person who was really good with the difficult to deal with dogs and so on. And I think what you have with somebody like him is somebody who has a natural gift for working with dogs.
I think you can have a natural gift for being a therapist, too. But minus any training, you're going to get yourself into trouble.
Right,
right.
You know, I'll talk a little bit about behavior and temperament, because it really is something that's becoming big in shelters of the late 20th and early 21st century. And I think it's going to be something that you see grow even more. In fact, we're fixing to open a satellite clinic in town that will also serve as a behavior center. So we can give people classes and we can work with these behavior issues, because Darren's exactly right. Most of the dogs that we get at the shelter, we get because of behavior issues. And most behavior issues are not the dog's fault. Dogs do what dogs do. The issue is, what have the people not done in order to make this a workable home environment for both human and canine? And these, what you see a lot more in shelters now are temperament testing, which come from a variety. There's a lot of different temperament tests you can use. We use one. We use a customized version of one by Dr. Emily Weiss, who's one of the country's leading canine behavior specialists. She is just a stunning, brilliant woman as far as canine behavior. But what you have when you do this is not just can we put this dog in adoption, but it's like a person. It's like Myers-Briggs for dogs. You know, you get a personality test. You get
Myers-Briggs is such utter and complete nonsense.
You get an idea of the animal that you're looking at, though, and I think that while most personality tests are pretty bogus, in my opinion, I think that with dogs we can get paint a very general picture. Is this dog going to be a resource guarder? Is this dog going to be aggressive with other dogs? How's this dog going to be with kids or surprises or loud noises or taking the food away, etc.? And if we identify these, then not only do we find the dogs that can move to adoption without much behavior modification at all, but it also lets us see, okay, this is an excellent dog with the exception that he's a resource guarder. So if you try to take his toys or his food away, you're going to have a problem. Well, that gives us an opportunity at that point, and more shelters are taking these opportunities to work with, again, the individual personalities and animals that you see. And I think our temperament tests, you know, with the thousands of adoptions we do every year, you have thousands of different temperament tests, and you absolutely see that no one dog is exactly like the other. And throughout the country, these behavior departments, these temperament departments, they really are making a difference for dogs because they recognize the complex nature of dog psychology, that one dog does not equal every dog.
It's not a dogmocracy.
It is not a dogmocracy, no. Well, you know, in that sense, it kind of is from a very figurative standpoint. If we talk about democracy being the coming together of many disparate ideas and beliefs and somehow finding a way to make them work in conjunction with each other, it kind of absolutely is a dogmocracy because what we have is I have three animals in my home, two dogs and a cat. That's three very different personalities that have had to find harmony with one another. They all have different preferences and needs. So they're jerks sometimes, and others are jerks at other times, and I'm a jerk at other times, and we all have to find a way to live together. And when Darren's talking about the importance of using these principles of behavior, that's really what it's about. It's about finding a way for these symbiotic relationships to continue to work for another 15,000 years and for them to be functional and humane.
Mm-hmm. And on that psycho-political note, it's time to go.
Well, that went really fast
it
today.
It did.
Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Darren Llewellyn is a veterinarian with Smith Veterinary Hospital. And where is Smith?
Smith's located on Alta Vista Drive on the corner of Luisa and Alta Vista, just right around the corner from the Radio Cafe and the Bacon Company. And you can reach us at 982-4418.
The shelter's at 983-4309. You can find a map to the shelter and see all our adoptable animals online at www.sfhumanesociety.org.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much for being here, and we will see you in about a month's time.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break right now. Poet James McGrath will be with us in just a moment. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome poet James McGrath. He has a book launch, and there's also an art exhibition. It's Monday, Monday of next week at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books, and he will be reading from his latest book of poetry, Speaking with Magpies. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
Now, you're a poet and an artist.
Yes.
Do both of these art forms interact with each other and play a role in your new book?
Well, I think they do. I do the covers, and I do the drawings inside. And I used to paint full-time or do sculpture, but I was tired of stretching canvas and carrying stones and having written many, many years from childhood until today. It all comes from the same source, so now I'm just using the words.
Now, you wrote poetry from early childhood on?
Right. I used to stutter, and I felt, I guess just intuitively, if I'm going to communicate, so to speak, I better write it out. And so I wrote a lot in school, and in high school I had a teacher read one of my poems in class. I never took it seriously. And then I just discovered that's kind of my voice now, is to write.
What happened when you decided to give up sculpture and visual art a little bit and move toward poetry, did you start approaching it in a different way than you had before?
I don't think so, because I was always a painter spontaneously and a sculptor without doing, you know, any sketching. And so when I write, I don't do any plotting. I put my pen to paper. I think Natalie Goldberg helped me. I took a workshop with her. She had one for men about 10 years ago. And I decided to take a workshop with her. And her approach is you put your pen down, you can say anything you want, and you don't stop until you're finished.
Now, that approach has certainly been used by many people all over the world, many people in Santa Fe. But there's also a part that's missing from that, which is the crafting, the rewriting.
Right.
How does that work for you?
I don't rewrite.
Really?
It is amazing. I mean, I'm in a couple writing groups, and when I write, they always say, wow, that's a keeper. And so I say, yeah, for me it's a keeper too. I'm not going to have to rewrite it.
Now, that's interesting. When you work with writing groups, I was once, years ago, in a writing group, and I was telling a friend about that, and he said, isn't that rather like writing by committee?
Well, in the groups I'm with, we, except for one, we don't do a lot of critique. We write, we share, we leave, we support, and there. For the most part, I'm not a very good critique myself, even my own work. So I like the spontaneity, and I like the idea of saying your truth, I guess.
Now, there are some themes that come up in your work, and one of them is you write a lot of poems that are dedicated to other people, to loved ones in your life.
Exactly. I'm 79 this year. And for me, I've had a lot of support in my life. I have people that I love dearly and people that care for me, and I want them to know of that. So I have both books. I have lots of dedications to friends, to families, to people who have gone, to grandchildren, and so on.
When you write poems to people who've passed on, what does it do for you?
Well, there's a certain amount of closure as well as a new opening. There's an opening to respect, to honor that relationship. And then there's that closure to say, goodbye, I've cared for you, and I appreciate what you've done for me in my life.
Now, when you write a poem to somebody who is living,
right,
does it create a new opening?
I think it does, because I can share it with them, and they say thank you.
Do they ever say, that's not me?
Well, I don't write about them. I usually try to write something that kind of reflects either my relationship with them or some kind of connection that I have.
Would you like to read some of your poems?
Yeah, I can even read one that I just spoke of.
Okay.
Let's see, if I know it's in here. I have a friend in town who loves Greece like I do. And so I wrote a poem for her.
We're working with the microphones here and talking to poet James McGrath.
And I wrote this when I was in Greece. And it's called Rizos and I. Rizos is a very fine contemporary Greek poet. And this is the poem I call Rizos and I. And this is for Maylou Denning, a friend of mine here in town. Like Rizos, I want to hold my breaky pot of coffee on top of fragrant dry twigs of thyme. What coffee that will be. I want us to rove across the night bay of Pantelli like Argonauts, Rizos pulling on the right oar, me pulling on the left. I'll carry my English-Greek, Greek-English dictionary with me. I'll ask for translations of the moon waves, like bits of quartz bouncing on the aquamarine sea. I'll ask for the words that say blurp, blurp to both of us as we dip our oars. He will have his mustache running across his upper lip and along his mouth edge to his chin. Out on the waters, there will be undulating splashes. There will be a Greek word for undulating splashes. I know we will gaze at the moon and see nothing, Rizos and I. He'll read poems to me in Greek, which I will understand without knowing a single word, like knowing what the moon says. Ritus will say, we've hidden inside each other. No one will find us, only the moon on your expectant lips. So that's one I dedicated to a friend who has a great love for Greece, as I do.
Now that's another theme that comes up, not so much Greece, but water and the sea.
Right. Oh, yeah. So, I was born in the Northwest, on Puget Sound area, so I do have some of that in my bloodstream.
We're talking to poet James McGrath, and he will actually be doing a book launch on May 14th, that's Monday at 5 o'clock, and we'll read from the latest book of poetry, Speaking with Magpies, and there will be an exhibition of the author's work also through the 21st of May. Talk about the title of the new book, Speaking with Magpies.
Well, my story is when I was in college, which was in the desert of the Washington State, my room was overlooking an irrigation ditch, and there were a lot of magpies in that area, and they would be out there picking up scraps and so on, and once one of them came up on my windowsill and became like a friend, and actually stayed around for a long time, and I guess I reflect on that I had this contact with this wild, beautiful creature. And so I've written from that aspect of connection. I do have a leading poem, if you'd like to hear it, Speaking with Magpies.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful. This is from my daughter, who also loves wildlife. The title is, There is a Magpie Inside Me. There is a magpie inside me next to the turtle and the dragonfly. It speaks at odd hours. At night, it awakens my dreaming foxes. It flies to far-off places, holding clouds tight among its feathers, its beak carrying juniper berries. It builds its nest in spring before all snow melts. It listens to the seeping sounds of winter weeping. There is a magpie inside me next to the horse and the pterodactyl. It waits, expecting hummingbirds to share their honey. It preens its wings, making shining mirrors for iridescent beetles and star-eyed gnats. It never sleeps. It carries the sun from one horizon to the other. It presses its head to my chest. It sings of loneliness and wild iris.
Poet James McGrath, and that's the title poem of Speaking with Magpies?
Right.
So how long did it take you? This is your second book of poetry. The first is called At the Edgelessness of Light. And by the way, both books are published by Santa Fe's own Sunstone Press.
A wonderful group of people.
Yeah. How long did, you have your whole life to write your first book of poetry. You have a year to write your second.
Right.
How does that work for you?
Oh, it's sort of endless. I mean, I haven't ever taken it seriously until I did these books, and now I can't stop. I have another book already, and I already told Jim Smith and Sunderson, I got a book ready for you. So, yes, I just go on and on and on, it seems.
You're working with a community of writers, but you must also have some favorite poets out in the world whom you admire and who serve as models for you.
Well, I do love the poets of the world. I think, you know, Rilke and Rumi, and as I say, this Greek poet Ritsos.
So they have to start with R, basically?
That's interesting, you're right. And I've studied with Sharon Olds, Mark Doty, Joan Logie here locally, Natalie Goldberg, David White in Ireland. These are probably my mentors and people I really can connect with, whether they're alive or dead.
When you study with a poet, what do they teach you?
They teach me, first of all, that this is what I should do with my life, is to write. I think that's the first thing they do. They also teach me that this is a way to live life fully, is to express myself and do it in whatever language I can, whether it's a paintbrush or a word, and right now it's the word.
We're talking to James McGrath. Now, where does the painting fit into your life right now?
Not very much. I still have my brushes and my paints and my papers, but I don't do very much of it because now the energy has gone into the work, so it doesn't really fit in terribly much like it used to.
Tell us about the artworks that are going to be in the exhibition at Garcia Street.
Well, they're basically going to be the three paintings that are my book covers, and then there will also be some bronzes I've done earlier. I live at the base of the petroglyphs in La Cienega, so I often use petroglyph images. So I've got bronzes that I have been inspired by the petroglyphs. And then I have the black and white drawings that I have in the Speaking with Magpies. That'll be the basically the artwork.
Have you lived in New Mexico a long time?
Since 1962, when I came to the Institute of American Indian Arts. And I was there at 11 years. Then I spent 12 years in Japan. Then I came back here in 85 and built my home out in La Cienega. Then I had time as a poet, artist, and resident with U.S. Information Service in Congo, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. So I've really been bouncing around the world. And I've always been involved with language.
Well, James McGrath, unfortunately our time is up, but it's wonderful to have you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great.
And we look forward to seeing you on Monday, the 14th of May, at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books.
Wonderful. And this is for you.
Oh, thank you. We're going to take a little break right now. And when we come back, we will be speaking with Molly Sturgis about Memory Lines. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Molly Sturgis and David Gallegos. They're here to talk about Memory Lines, Santa Fe, Voces de Nuestras Jornadas, a contemporary opera happening this weekend at the Lensic. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, this is called a contemporary opera. Is it really an opera?
Well, I suppose it depends how you define it. It certainly is from the origin of the work, obras, referring to a musical work. It is an entirely musical piece from beginning to end. Where it differs from popular conceptions of opera is that we are working with, the ensemble consists of people from many different communities in Santa Fe, many of whom have never performed before. And many of whom are certainly not singers, professional singers, although there are a few amazing vocalists. And we do have a small orchestra and two vocalists singing with them. So there is a lot of voice, but there's also a lot of spoken word, personal story. But it certainly brings all the tools of operas in the sense of set design and costumes, and we have contemporary video and lighting and music, and yeah.
Our hope, too, is that people that are traditional opera fans will come with an open mind into seeing something a little bit different and new. And also people that maybe don't necessarily know much about opera might come and not be scared away by the word opera.
Now, the concept is Memory Lines, and it's about Santa Fe. How did you put this all together?
Well, Molly got together a group of artists, and you know, it's kind of superficial to try and put together a real representation of Santa Fe. That's just not really feasible. And so,
you mean the tricultural paradise?
Yeah, exactly.
let's break that one down.
Molly got together this artist team, and she just said, "Let's make this really relational." And so she invited the artist team to just ask community members, and we just said, let's see what we get, and we
watched. Ask community members what?
Anything. I mean, it could be just anyone that you knew.
To be a part of the piece.
To be a part of the project, yeah. And so to invite them to be part of the ensemble. And so we walked into the room the first day, and there were 30-some people. That was just this really beautiful collage of Santa Fe.
It was. We generally take about 4 months to develop a project like this. It's original work, and the work that we do out of Little Globe, our nonprofit, are these very in-depth community collaborations. And so, in a sense, really, 24 people wrote the libretto to this opera, and we worked together over 4 months to develop trust and engagement, a lot of different creative mediums, and from that came the source material for the actual performance.
Now, from that came the source material. It's when Memory Lines, it's not one storyline, it's many storylines. Are they actually stories? Are they vignettes?
There's both stories and vignettes, actually. What this piece is about is multiplicity of perspective, experience here, and also the things, not just the things that separate us across cultural and economic and generational boundaries in Santa Fe, but also the things that connect us. So there's this incredible shared joy and tenderness that is in the ensemble and will show in the piece, but it certainly is also about the very different experiences. There's people will find a lot about identity, about the experience of immigration, about
the relationship to land,
about stories that are missing, you know, what isn't included here, where are the memories that are hidden and still are very hidden or suppressed. And it's not a representative piece. It's a little, it's a little slice of the pie of these people who came together.
When you talk about the things that unite us across all of these boundaries, what are some of those things that unite us across these boundaries?
Well, we did something about just your daily life, kind of, you know, to kind of get a glimpse into people's daily lives. And so when you start seeing that, there's very kind of commonalities about how we each spend our day. And then we do a section on family as well, and the relationship to family. So those were some of the, I think, big intersections in terms of things that we had in common.
Yeah. Now, you are, Molly, composer, co-composer and director of this piece, and it's a musical piece. Did you compose the music, or using some traditional New Mexican music, Mexican music? What's the musical aspect?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I knew from the very beginning I really didn't want to set out and do something that I've seen a lot here when you try to sort of bring different cultural groups together, is that the music exists side by side a little bit. And we have incredible musical forms here that are mixes that have, you know, as music does, sort of evolves and changes with cultural interaction. But what we wanted to do was something just totally different. So what people will find is whispers of traditional music, just like a layer, but it's wrapped up in a very surprising context. And I think people will find that they probably haven't heard music like this, and yet they'll recognize elements. And we have a fantastic Afro-Cuban soloist from Albuquerque, Ramon Calderon, who is amazing, and he's part of the ensemble as well. So there's this really unique quality to it. And again, we weren't trying to represent perfectly all the different musics of this region, and yet people will hear elements of that.
The Afro-Cuban music of northern New Mexico.
That's right. Don't you know about that? But it exists, actually, you know, here.
Now, you've done projects like this before. You did something in Ireland.
Yeah, I did a large-scale project with older homeless adults and youth in Ireland for the European Union Festival of Culture, and that was also a four-month project. And Little Globe has grown since that time. We've got David, myself, Chris Jonas, Valerie Martinez, and Penny Ray, who's based in Belgium. And we are increasingly devoted to this kind of work because we see so much coming out of this process of integrating community building and dialogue together with this sort of rigorous artistic process and developing works that really have this sort of professional quality as well. And that project was actually performed in a nursing home that was incredibly isolated, so the public came in. But it was the same kind of thing. It was a professional team that worked together with community members. And we work in collaboration. We don't really see ourselves as in a helping mode or even as facilitators, but just straight-out collaborators. So we're really breaking down hierarchies about who's creating contemporary art, how it's being created, and where it's being created. And so we have a number of really interesting projects being launched this coming year that even take us farther into the realms of complexity around social and environmental issues.
We're talking to Molly Sturges and David Gallegos. David, what's your role in Memory Lines?
Well, I'm the production director for the project, but I'm also on stage as well. I'm performing, as is most of the artist team.
What's your role as a performer?
Well, we're all on stage kind of at different points doing spoken word. We all sing, we all move.
Did you make up the parts that you're doing?
Well, not specifically. What I'm reading is the words that I wrote, but journals were all taken from all of us, and Penny Ray and Valerie Martinez sculpted the libretto from all of our writings. So what I'm reading is my words, but it was kind of shaped by Valerie and Penny in terms of the piece that I read.
I mean, I think that one of the greatest challenges of this would be making it cohesive.
Oh, yeah. I think that you can't, you know, we're not doing a meta-narrative, so what are you going to do? You know, you have a few choices in terms of how you're going to create a structure. We put a lot of faith in the structure that comes. There's a loose form. There's definitely a form. People will be able to follow a progression. But I would say the music goes a long way, and the visual identities to creating also a kind of a through line.
There's also, as Molly mentioned earlier, there's lots of layers. You know, there's these stories that are being layered. The set has a very layered feel to it. The video has a very layered feel. So, and the music as well. So,
what's the nature of the video? Is it talking heads is there more visual art thing?
You've seen more of the video, Molly.
Yeah, it was made with the ensemble members. Chris Jonas actually got the New Visions Award from the film office for this project, which was really incredible for experimental video. So it is more abstract, and that's one thing that's really interesting about this piece is that there's so much warmth. That, you know, we have 8 years old to 88 years old on stage. We have people who are coming from Santa Fe Cares Nursing Home. We have Alameda School Kids. We've been working with those two community institutions the whole time. And there's this kind of incredible beauty of them on stage and hearing them. And then the context, I would say, is very contemporary in a way. The video is large scale. There's one scene where there's live video, so we have two additional projectors. Agnes Martinez is writing the names of her ancestors on a piece of paper, and that's being projected onto the screen behind. So there's all this kind of unexpected, it's very beautiful, and hopefully it will inspire us and show us something unique about life here.
Now, this is this coming weekend, May 11th, 12th, and 13th at the Lenzic. You've been putting a lot of time into this. You've got your big weekend. What happens to the material after that?
Good question. Well, we're hoping to actually take Memory Lines on tour to some smaller local communities. So we would like to continue working with a lot of the ensemble members now, but we'd like to take it kind of on the road and
in New Mexico?
In New Mexico to some smaller rural communities.
We're thinking that the thing to do is to reshape the piece into a smaller piece with smaller number of cast, and then do several creative workshops with partnering communities, rural, more isolated communities. And we would work with them and then bring some of their stories, concerns, and expressions into the piece, and possibly as performers as well. And we really believe, Little Globe really believes in making a three-year commitment to the communities we work with. So we feel like we've just begun, even though this was originally commissioned from the opera and the Lenzic. It has its own momentum now.
And so all of that is this weekend, May 11th, 12th, 13th. That's Friday, Saturday, Sunday at the Lenzic. The number over there is 988-1234. It's a Little Globe production. What time does the performance start each night?
7 o'clock Friday and Saturday. And the performance on Sunday, Mother's Day, is 2 o'clock.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here, Molly Sturges and David Gallegos. It's called Memory Lines, Santa Fe, Voces de Nuestras Jornadas. A contemporary opera. Thanks, ladies
Thank
and gentlemen.
You.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. KSFR streams live on the internet. Well, I said that, but we are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. Let's see. Thanks so much to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.